Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratfold, Judge Ross, Judge Clary, the Honorable Diane B. Bratfold presiding.
Good morning. Let's all be seated. Again, good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is March 20th, 2025, and I want to remind counsel of things that you're probably well aware of. I see the lawyers for the first matter are in front of us, and I'll just say a few remarks. First of all, today's proceedings are made available via Zoom. They're also recorded. There's an audio recording. And so what I will ask of the lawyers is that you identify yourselves as well as the clients you represent. And then please, when you approach the podium, if you would make yourselves comfortable, raise it, lower it, do whatever you need, and then indicate who you represent and who you are. We do have four matters before this panel today. Two of those matters are oral, and as I said, I see the lawyers here for the first matter. So I believe we're ready to proceed, and Marsha, I'll ask you to call the first case.
Case A240995, the Castle Rock Group, LLC, et al. Appellants versus Ryan Litfin, et al. Respondents.
And counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is John Nevy, and I'm here to represent the appellants, the Castle Rock Group, and East West Global. We are here today because the district court entered judgment as a matter of law in favor of the respondents, allowing the respondents to escape liability for their breach of fiduciary duty and conversion. There's three primary issues before the court. The first one was the district court too narrow in its interpretation of the rule of damages in this case. It said that this was a lost profits case that was too narrow. Whether the district court erred in precluding the jury from hearing or considering the evidence of damages that the appellants did present, it said it was insufficient. And then also whether there was sufficient evidence to establish equitable claims that the court could have then fashioned remedies for such as an accounting, rescission, or constructive trust. The standard that this court will apply is very, very lenient and favorable to the appellant in this case. The court must construe all evidence in favor of the appellants. And this court and the Supreme Court have made it clear that judgment as a matter of law should only be granted in unequivocal cases. This is not one of them. So, Your Honor, this is a complicated business structure that these individuals created. So let me give you a very quick overview of what's going on here.
So, counsel, if you don't mind, before you proceed with the factual summary,
sure.
Again, we've read the facts, but go ahead.
If the court doesn't need it, I'm happy to answer questions.
You mentioned at the outset your claims for breach of fiduciary duty and conversion. Now, there, as I understood it, but I could be wrong, there were more claims that were tried or theories that were presented at trial. Have you narrowed things down at this point to those two causes of action?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, you know, there was a lot of other properties at issue that were allegedly converted by the respondents. We limited trial to just these three properties, and the evidence that we presented, I think, most closely matches up with breach of fiduciary duty and conversion. There were breach of contract. There's breach of the operating agreement, but the operating agreement includes this duty, this breach of fiduciary duty. So I do think those overlap, Your Honor. But I do think for purposes of the case, the breach of fiduciary duty directly shows why the district court should be reversed. Breach of fiduciary claims are equitable claims. And I have found no case in Minnesota that has limited breach of fiduciary duty cases to lost profit analysis. Pedro versus Pedro, a landmark case that this court is well aware of, rescissionary damages were available in that case to remedy a breach of fiduciary duty. Indeed, the statute itself, which the counts for breach of fiduciary duty cite, Minnesota Statute 322C.0409, and in that statute it says members and managers must, quote, account to the company and hold as trustee for it any property, profit, or benefit derived. So there, the duty of accounting is in the statute itself, which is the basis of the claim that the appellants brought. So the district court, he said, you know, if we're going to focus on, he said that there was a legal remedy available. And this, his ruling actually contradicts his exact standing in that legal remedy was not sufficient because of the breach of fiduciary duty by the respondents. They withheld information. They did these transfers in secret. They actively covered up these transactions in direct violation of their fiduciary duty.
Counsel, the court went farther than that and suggested that this was in great part a lack of discovery.
Right. Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. And I think that's unfair in that so the prior counsel was excluded or had to withdraw from the case because of a conflict of interest. We were brought in after discovery had closed, after motions to compel could be brought. No depositions had been done in this case. No independent document production had been done in this case, it's my recollection. We brought that to the court and said, hey, we need to do this discovery. You know, we just got retained by this case. So it's. I think that the court should take that into account when Judge Connolly says that, he's the one that created that problem, I would argue.
But you're not appealing procedurally, as I understand your...
Well, we raised it in our... You know, when you appeal from the judgment, you're appealing all orders that go into that judgment. We have raised that in our brief as an issue. But honestly, Your Honor, you're not going to reverse based upon that, on that issue. I just...
Right. Counsel, I just want to point out there was no motion to compel pending. I mean, there was no challenge to the district court's decision regarding discovery, whatever that, you've alluded to it very generally. I'm not even sure there was a decision.
Yeah, no, the deadlines had passed, and we brought a motion to extend discovery. It was denied.
And I don't see that as an issue in your brief.
Fair enough, Your Honor. But, I think that you have to read what Judge Connolly said in that context, that he's blaming us for not doing discovery and then denied us doing discovery.
But why? I mean, I appreciate what you're saying, but it seems like you're suggesting we put our thumb on the scale a bit in your favor because of some implied unfairness by the district court. But that unfairness isn't challenged on appeal, and it wasn't raised in the district court.
So it's you're correct, Your Honor. We are not directly appealing that because the better issue is we had evidence of damages. The district court disregarded it. It weighted in favor of the appellant or the respondents. And let's take a look at what that evidence was. So we have three properties, Urbana, Lake Jonathan, and Vincent Woods. It's undisputed that those properties were under the umbrella of Castle Rock. In the fall of 2018, there was a dispute amongst the partners. The relationship broke down. Mr. Litvin and Mr. Francis transferred out for no consideration those three properties, the membership unit. They cut off the organization chart, which effectively pulled the properties out from Castle Rock. And we have a personal financial statement that says, this is what we own. This is our value. This is what they told the bank under oath. We have $500,000 each in equity in Lake Jonathan. We have, it's in the brief, so almost $2.5 million of equity. And the district court said the jury couldn't rely on that personal financial statement. But for conversion, the damages is what was the value of the property at the time of the taking. And what we have is this personal financial statement within a year or so of the taking saying, hey, this is what we say the property was worth. Now, respondents will say, well, that's because that's the money we put in. There's no evidence to support that. That's a bald assertion without any documented evidence. They never produced that in discovery. They admitted that in court, that they have documents, but they've never produced them. It's the first time I have ever heard that issue. That's never was asserted in the entire case, Your Honor, until that day of trial. So,
counsel, I need to interrupt just because I want to be clear on something. The transfer of the properties from Vincent Real Estate Group occurred, I believe, in November of 18. Does that sound right?
That's correct.
All right. And the balance statements that were provided, at least the one I'm looking at now, is February of 20.
So there's one in December of 2019, is my recollection, Your Honor.
So there's one 13 months and one about 15 months.
Correct.
And the court found those unreliable because of the length of time that had gone by and there'd been development. You seem to challenge that.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That goes to the weight of those personal financial statements. They could have argued, hey, they're stale. That's not an accurate valuation. It was a lot less. It was a lot more. They could have challenged. They could have explained that the value changed between October of 18. We presented that evidence. They said that was inaccurate as of the time. The snapshots didn't change when we have two financial statements, they're the exact same value. So it goes to weight, Your Honor. The judge took the place of the jury and said, no, that's too old. But that's an argument to the jury to weigh it.
Well, at some point, doesn't the span of time, at what point does it go from just weight to we're into speculation in order to determine what the damages are?
Your Honor, much longer than this. Years, multiple decades. We cited the cases in the brief where they relied on personal financial statements that were much older than 13 months. So 13, it seems to me that, sure, there can be a case where personal financial statements are so old that they're unreliable or they're too speculative. This is not that case. Particularly, it's real estate. It doesn't fluctuate like a stock or a private placement in a company. It's real estate, and they didn't change in theirs over the iterations of their personal financial statement. We also...
So, counsel, if you don't mind...
Of course not.
You mentioned the nature of it being real estate, and that's interesting, because I read the district court's decision, and maybe I'm blending the oral JMOL with the motion for new trial, but the district court's reasoning is in part that it would require speculation for the jury to rely on the financial statements so that it is, as Judge Ross's question asked you and you gave us an answer, that would be the timing is just too attenuated. And the second is that it's undisputed that these properties were developed after they were transferred, developed as in buildings were built on them. They were unbuilt before that time, and that there was no evidence offered to explain, to articulate whether, you know, if the plaintiff's position was that they get to count the entire value on those financial statements, then that's sort of a missing part of the foundation for the plaintiff's claim. So would you respond to that?
Of course,
or tell me that that's not what the district court said, either way.
So let's, first of all, the valuation that they gave at the time was for a potential development. And that was
time of the financial statements?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. And so these products were worth hundreds of millions combined once they're developed and cash flowing. Yeah, that it changes. But this was their valuation at the time of that status of the project. And the respondents have decades of experience in valuing and developing real commercial property. So their personal financial statements have weight. And it shows exactly what they own in it. So the jury could have said, we believe that that's what they took. That equity in their personal financial statements, those three properties show up on their personal financial statements. They shouldn't have, because they were Castle Rock entities. They should have been, not transferred out. And the jury could have said, look, that's, they say that's what they got. They got that wrongly. We're going to use that as our damages. If we had, if the judge had let the jury do that, you would likely affirm their holding. They'd say, well, there's evidence to support. They didn't believe the respondents that they put in their own cash because they didn't have any documentation to prove that. Hundreds of thousands of dollars invested into these real properties, but they don't have a shred of evidence to corroborate it. A jury could weigh that evidence and say, nope, we should have that. In fact, that's what the judge should have done. He should have reserved judgment or denied the judgment as a matter of law, let the jury take the case, issue their decision. Who knows what they would have done? It's impossible to predict. But if they had found there was a breach of fiduciary duty and damages, and the judge said, well, the damages are speculative, I am going to fix that with my equitable powers, with the jury as an advisory on the equitable claims, I'm going to call for an accounting, get in here, respondents, we're going to figure this out. You say it's complicated, there's pools, there's closings, you lost money on Urbana because of COVID. Okay, you're a fiduciary. Let's get in here and let's figure it out. That would have done justice in this case. Instead, the court let them off and put a very, lost profits is, he said, you have to prove lost profits in a breach of fiduciary duty case. No case in Minnesota has ever said that. It's just not the law. And my colleague was very good at keeping the judge to focus on lost profits, and that ultimately carried the day. That was an error of law. He applied the wrong legal standard, and on that basis alone, the judgment as a matter of law should be reversed. I see my time is up.
Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Marshall's just noting that she started the timer 10 seconds into appellant's argument. I think that favors you, so I think we just go right ahead. So, counsel for respondent, you're ready, it looks like, and we're ready to listen to you.
Thank you. Good morning. Yeah. Justice Lindell, Greenstein Sellers, for respondents Ryan Litvin and Dale Francis. Your Honors, this appeal is a disguised appeal of the district court or the trial court's denial of a motion to reopen discovery. It's all over the briefs. It's all over what happened at trial. That's not an issue that's been raised on this appeal. And I think it's not an appropriate basis to grant relief. And I think when you work through the papers and you look at this, that's really what's going on here. This is a case about alleged usurped business opportunities. So there's allegations that the respondents, two different things. There's allegations that the respondents took a property that was held together under the partnership entity that everyone equally had ownership interest in, and they moved that ownership interest into a different entity that they themselves were the only owners. That's the Rogers property. There's also allegations that the defendants invested in two other opportunities, Urbana and I think the last one's Johnson. Pardon me. I've got the list. Thank you, Jonathan. Those were not transfers where anything was moved from one company to another company. That was an alleged usurpation of an opportunity. There was an opportunity to invest in these two properties. The defendants invested outside of the partnership. They didn't take partnership money and invest it so that the partnership could profit. They used their own money and invested. And the claim was they should have taken that opportunity, brought it to the partnership, and let everybody invest. So it's really important to be specific about the opportunities at issue. We're talking about conversion. When you read the complaint, the conversion was actually conversion of profits from these deals. There was no allegation of conversion of an ownership interest. And that conversion, the taking of an ownership interest and moving it somewhere else, that would only apply to the shares of an LLC, right? So it's important for us to be specific regarding the opportunities at issue.
So, Counsel, more fundamentally, I guess I've been wondering, so maybe you can answer the question. Is it disputed at this point in time whether the respondents breached their fiduciary duty? I don't see that as an issue that the district court directly considered or resolved? Was it assumed?
Of course, I mean, yes, of course the defendants dispute. If you look at their operating agreements under which they were operating, they had the right to do independent investments. It said that they could have side deals. And that's what they did. So the testimony at trial was that for the Rogers project, that Rogers project predated the partnership. The ownership of the Rogers project was in the Vincent VREG, I believe. And when they started the partnership up with Luke Adrian and the other companies, that's when they moved ownership of their current entity into a partnership with other entities. And because that partnership had not invested anything into that Rogers project, right? So that Rogers project was already under Vincent when Vincent became part of the partnership. When the plaintiffs decided that they weren't going to invest.
If you don't mind, I know your time will go quickly. Yep. So I think I understand correctly that for the purposes of the JMOL and the motion for new trial, the district court assumed, with that the standard it had to apply, that when the properties were transferred, they were actually transferred from the Vincent to other Vincent entities, right?
Correct.
So
it was
you're explaining your view of the evidence at the beginning of this, but that's not really what was in front of the court for the purposes of JMOL.
For the purposes of JMOL, right. The issue was for the property that was transferred, and you have a conversion claim there, you measure your damages conversion, what's the value of the property at the time it was transferred. The property that was transferred was a number of interests, shares, in an LLC. That LLC owns a piece of real property. So the question isn't what was the real property worth. The question is what were the shares worth in the LLC, those shares which were transferred away from the plaintiffs. And the law is that in order to understand what shares are worth, and this is the Hawkins case cited in our brief, the actual value is determined at the fair price at which a person who desires to buy would be willing to pay, taking into consideration capital, profits, losses, carrying on the business, assets and liabilities. What are the bank debts? None of that information was introduced at trial. There was no information at trial from which the value of the ownership interest in an LLC could be evaluated.
So now, what's stated on the personal financial statements?
So what's stated on the personal financial statements, the only evidence at trial was that the information in the personal financial statement represented the equity investment by Mr. Litvin and Mr. Francis. So that's...
Well, it includes in a statement of equity, but it also includes the value of the asset, right?
So, well, there's two different things going on. There was a statement of what was there's a statement about what is the value of the real property, and what they did was they took the purchase price, and this is the testimony. This is docket 107, and we have the citations in our brief. The testimony was they took the purchase price of the real property plus the bank debt, and then that's what's reflected. So that's not a valuation of the property. It's a valuation of what money was put into it.
So is that equivalent or arguably evidence of their LLC interest?
No, it's evidence of what it is, right? It's evidence we bought a piece of property and then we took out a big loan because we're going to build on that property, we're going to start a business, we're going to hire employees, et cetera, et cetera. The other number that was in there was, 10.7%. That was the amount that they had personally invested. That was the only evidence at trial, was what was reflected in their personal financial statement, was their own personal, my money, I put my money into the kitty, so I have a 10.7% interest in this LLC that owns a piece of real property. So again, that's not evidence of what those shares are worth, it's evidence of what they invested in hopes that at the end of the day, when the property was developed and they had a business up and running, either a senior living facility or an apartment building, that they could then sell that, and then if there was enough money left over after you pay off the bank debt, your employees, the first tranche investors, and everybody else, you're gambling, right, that there's going to be money left over and there's going to be profits. And when you read the complaint, every single one of these claims, count one and two, breach of fiduciary duty, count three, conversion, count three, breach of contract, and then counts five and six for conversion. All of those claims in the complaint stated the same thing. We were deprived of these opportunities, and the defendants took the money And that was our money. Every single one of those claims says that the defendants received profits on these deals, that it was, and that was the damage that was being requested to be recovered. They got the money instead of us. Even the conversion claim says they received money, and they took that money when it should have been our money. So this is all about money damages. That's what went to trial. That's what this case was. So the appellants were offered the opportunity, was the testimony at trial, to invest in these projects, and they declined because they didn't like them. In order to invest in these projects, you had to sign up for the bank debt. Mr. Castle testified at length. Only an idiot would do that. He would never sign a guarantee for the bank debt. So when we're talking about equity and whether these were opportunities that the partnership wanted to pursue but were wrongfully prevented from pursuing, the actual evidence and testimony at trial was they were asked if they wanted to invest in Urbana, and
Jonathan Vias. That you're making, counsel, doesn't go to the damages issue that the district court.
Well, we're talking about when there's a conversation about equity, I like to make sure that we're all talking about the
okay,
same
so
thing.
So you've moved on to the equity argument. Okay.
But most particularly as to the equity argument, Your Honor, and the Shepherd of the Valley case is right on point with this. You can have an equity claim, but what you have to do is demonstrate that you were damaged. So in Shepherd of the Valley, right, and if you want relief for your claim of evidence, of equity, you still have to show that you were damaged. And in Shepherd of the Valley, the court specifically determined, the jury was asked if there were damages, and the jury found that, yes, they had been damaged by the breach of fiduciary duty. Right, so the jury found the church suffered damages or losses which were caused by the breach of fiduciary duty, and that $7,752.99 would fairly and adequately compensate them for part of those damages. So there was a finding of damage. Minnesota law is clear that a breach of fiduciary duty claim requires you to show damages before you're entitled to relief. And we keep hearing these arguments about, well, you could do a constructive trust. Yes, if you showed that you were damaged. The law is, if there's a breach of fiduciary duty and no loss results, then there's no violation of a legal right. That's the Pearl v. St. Paul Fire case cited in our brief. So you can't end around the requirement to show that you've been damaged by saying, oh, well, we want an accounting. No, that's discovery. That is a cause of action where that was not pled in this case. There's no cause of action for accounting. A constructive trust is a remedy that you may be granted, but first you have to get over the hurdle. You have to show that you were damaged. If there's no damage, then there was no breach of fiduciary duty. And they don't have any evidence of damages. That's what happened in this case. There was a request to reopen discovery to go after damages evidence, and the court denied that. And if you look at the record on that, it's because there was absolutely no effort taken for months at a time in the trial court case to proceed with discovery until all the deadlines had elapsed. So at the end of the day, in order for someone to say, I was damaged by a breach of fiduciary duty and excluding me from Jonathan Flats and from Urbana, then they have to be able to show, what did you get excluded from? How much money did these defendants make from their involvement in Urbana? There's no evidence in the record of that.
Well, no evidence is an exaggeration, I think, counsel. I mean, the district court didn't look at it as inadequate evidence as opposed to no evidence, or evidence that required speculation from the jury, right?
I'm not going to put words in the district court's mouth. The point being, and if you look at the briefs, there's no evidence of any profit that was received by the defendants from participating in the Urbana
deal. But there
are
the defendants' own statements as to the value of these properties, and
but
several.
Understood, Your Honor. But right. The value of the property in 2018, even if that was evidence of that, which it was not, and the only testimony at trial was that this was evidence of how much they had invested. Remember that what we're talking about with respect to personal financial statement is a measurement of conversion damages. Conversion asks you to show what the property was worth at the time it was moved away. So that doesn't apply to the Urbana, because that wasn't moved away. Urbana was an opportunity where the defendants invested their own money, and the plaintiffs are claiming that that was wrong. The testimony and the evidence was, and there's emails, and these are all cited in our brief, they were asked if they wanted to get in on that investment and sign up the bank debt and put in their money, and the plaintiffs said no. And there was an argument at trial about, well, they only asked us like 2 days before the deadline. Setting that aside, that's not conversion. That was the argument for breach of fiduciary duty and breach of contract that the defendants had independently invested in opportunities that should have been an opportunity for the partnership. The only measure of damages for that lost corporate opportunity to make an investment would be the lost profits. There was no evidence at all of what was the outcome of the Jonathan Flats or Urbana projects. Did the defendants make any money at all? There was no evidence in the record that they did or did not. So there was nothing from which a jury could determine that the plaintiffs had been damaged by losing out on the opportunity to invest in Urbana and Jonathan Flats. The conversion goes to Rogers. Rogers was the only one where there's evidence that the LLC shares were moved out of the partnership into a different entity. So the question for that is, what were those LLC shares worth at the time that they were moved in November of 2018? The only evidence in the record that theoretically could pertain to that was the personal financial statements. But those personal financial statements, first, they only showed what the defendants themselves had invested in the property as being what their equity was worth. They said that was the number.
They don't only show equity. They also show the value of the property as an asset and then the liability as well.
Yes, it showed the purchase price of the property plus the bank debt, which is not the fair market value of the shares.
Got it. But it's evidence of all of these things.
I understand the statement, but the law is clear that when you're going to evaluate the value of an ownership interest in an LLC, there's a lot more that goes into it than what was the original purchase price of an asset that the LLC owns and what was the original amount of bank debt that the LLC took out on that. That question isn't answered in those personal financial statements. In 2018, there's no evidence of what additional debt there was, how many other investors there were, how many layers
if
of...
You would, counsel, respond. Yes. And I appreciate there's this whole range of things that could be added to the financial statements to
Correct.
Explain them. It seems to me that what we're confronted with is, A, the appellant's argument that all goes to the weight of the evidence, not whether it's sufficient evidence or evidence from which a jury can reach a reasonable conclusion on damages, and B, that we're faced with a situation where we are required to view that evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party.
Well, I would say two things about that. Mm-hmm. First is the law is clear that in order to value an LLC share, you have to have more information than simply what was the purchase price of a piece of real property that they bought plus the amount of the bank debt. That's the Hawkins case. And it's undisputed that all that additional information we're talking about is not there. It wasn't in the record. So the law is clear that there's a number of different types of information that you have in order to value an LLC share. That information's not in the record. That's undisputed. Second, there's the idea of, and I just want to finish responding to your question, Your Honor.
Oh, go right ahead, counsel. Wrap up.
And I lost my train of thought. Had something. I was going to be magical, Your Honor.
Yeah, I'm sure
it's
it was.
Okay.
No,
you'll remember on your way home.
No, I'll remember in about an hour and then kick myself.
And I was going to check with anybody else on the panel have a question? No.
Thank you.
Any last thoughts? No? Okay.
I'm trying to remember what it was that you had asked me, because there's the information that's in the record itself and then from which there has to be sufficient. Oh, that's why. Yeah. So it could only be speculative. And the second thing was, we're talking about taking everything in light that leans towards the appellant, but that's not true. The standard review for this, denial of a motion for new trial, is abuse of discretion.
If that's the motion we're looking at, right.
And yeah. Also, we cited the recent case where the district court's decision whether or not damages evidence went to the jury is also reviewed for abuse of discretion. Mm-hmm. There's been no abuse of discretion here. And, in fact, they didn't even argue abuse of discretion in their briefs. Thank you, mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What about the outlays, including the $250,000 for promotion? Isn't that non-speculative?
That is absolutely speculative, Judge, and there's two big problems with that argument. The first problem is there's no evidence. So what we're talking about is that Luke Adrian testified that the partnership had spent over $1 million in carrying the cost of carrying the business. There's no link between that to the investments that we're talking about. There's no evidence. Hey, we gave Vincent $200,000 for operating costs or whatever, and they took that money and they invested it in these projects without us. That's not what this case is about, and there was no evidence of that. So the idea that, well, we had some general carrying costs for the partnership, and that somehow equates to a measure of damages, I mean, there's no case law on that. There's no explanation of how the fact that it costs some money to have some commercials or that they paid money to have an office open, how that somehow is their measure of damages for being excluded from a lost corporate opportunity to make an investment, right? If that investment failed, their damages have nothing to do with carrying costs of the business. They would have no damages if the investment failed. You know, and on the other side, if the investment was wildly profitable, then the profits are how you would measure their damages. Again, it has nothing to do with whether they spent some money to keep the lights on at the business or to have Culligan drop off water. Second, Your Honor, the biggest problem with that argument is that it wasn't made to the trial court. So that's a new argument that was introduced on appeal as a new way of trying to take a look at what happened in the trial court, which is, I mean, these are good lawyers. It was a great argument. But it wasn't made at the time that it needed to be made. And we can't say that the trial court erred when the trial court didn't even hear this argument. The trial court wasn't even given an opportunity to think about these things, right? This is a new theory on appeal, and that's in our briefs as well. You can't get there from here. Thank you, everyone.
The circularity and the absurdity of the argument that to get a constructive trust, you have to know exactly, you have to be able to prove with specificity your damages. Constructive trust.
I don't think that was the argument.
I meant accounting.
Well, either way, I thought the argument was in order to get equitable relief, you have to show that you at least were damaged.
Yep,
Different from showing the specific damages. I think that was the argument. Maybe I'm wrong.
Your Honor, to allude to Judge Bratfold's statement, there is evidence of damage in this case. It's not that there's no damage or we didn't prove any damage. If the argument is that it's too speculative, we can't rely on it. So we did prove some damage, and we cited the cases where a cause of action for a breach of fiduciary duty starts when there's a loss of a legal right. The evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the appellants is that we lost a legal right in all three of these properties in October of 2018. Mr. Lindell says we're only talking about Rogers, but the testimony was absolutely clear that all three of these real estate developments were within Castle Rock, and all three were excluded. And there's no debate about that. Now, they say it's because there was the appellants didn't participate in putting money in or signing personal guarantees. Mr. Castle's testimony on this is just on point. He said that was never the business structure. There was a whole email where they said, we're going to raise money from these investors, put them into properties, and then sell them off, and then these properties will become all ours, and our business model is to use other investors' money to grow this portfolio of commercial real estate and eventually not need other people's money. That was the respondent's own words. And then when things got south, they made up this requirement for capital calls, for personal guarantees. That's the first time they show up in the record is in October. And at the same time, the same day, Your
this
Honor.
All goes, I think this all goes to whether there was a breach, not to whether the breach damaged your client.
If they take the property out of Castle Rock, which is undisputed, there's a loss of legal right. That's damage. You know, the loss of legal right triggers the court's equitable powers.
Counsel, I don't think you're stating that quite right. It's the whether there's a legal remedy at law before any equitable award can be made. And as I read this case, that's a big problem for you because you have... In fact, you are very close to submitting a legal remedy to the jury. You know, as you've called it today, the conversion claim at a minimum was very close to getting to the jury and failed merely because the district court determined the evidence would have required the jury to speculate. So I don't see where you get to an equitable
remedy. So if we have a legal claim that we can't prove damages because the respondents have the information to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. Like all the things that Justice Lindell said, you know, we need to prove, they have that. But they didn't give it to us. But we're fiduciaries, and they're withholding that information. But, Your Honor, on the $2.2 million that was put in, opposing counsel says we didn't raise that in the district court. We cited in our reply that we raised it in our briefing to the court. It's in the, we discussed it at the motion for new trial. So that's just not true. Second, rescission damages. We said we're going to get together. We're going to put all of the money, money generated from East West Global, is going to fund the acquisition of this commercial real estate. $2.2 million went in, undisputed that that's what flowed into Castle Rock to fund the operations, with the intent that these properties would produce a profit at the end. Instead of producing a profit, two were sold, one still owned by the respondents. Instead of making a profit, they took it. So rescission damages are absolutely appropriate. To give them back, put them where they would to fix the breach. You put in 2.2, you got nothing back. All right, they get to keep the properties, you get your money back. Perfectly legitimate calculation of damages. And Your Honor, the abuse of discretion, I disagree that that's the standard. I looked at the cases that they cited. None of them involved a judgment as a matter of law where they took the case out from the jury. This is the case law is clear that only in unequivocal cases should the jury not hear the case. Again, practically speaking, the judge should have let it would be very good, it would be helpful in this case to have a jury verdict. We don't do that. We don't have that. The judge should have submitted to the jury and then dealt with any speculative damages issues based upon their findings. They did not do that. Your Honor, we ask that you reverse the district court to undo a grave injustice. The law and fiduciary duty will be damaged significantly, I posit, if you affirm this ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both lawyers in this case. The matter was well briefed and well argued. It's now submitted to this court for a decision, and we will issue a decision within a statutory time frame. Thank you. We're now ready to go ahead in the